The most important insight here is that when we reach experiential identification with absolute consciousness, we realize that our own being is ultimately commensurate with the entire cosmic network, with all of existence. And this revelation concerning the identity of the individual with the divine is the ultimate secret that lies at the core of all great spiritual traditions. Of course, it might be expressed in somewhat different forms. So in the Upanishads, we have the famous statement, Tattvam Asi, thou art that. Nama Rupa, we are not the name and the shape. Our true identity is Atman Brahman. The followers of Siddha Yoga hear in many, many different variations the basic tenet of their school, which is God dwells within you as you. If we look at the Buddhist scriptures, we can read, look within, you are the Buddha. We look at the Confucian tradition, we are told that heaven, earth, and human are one body. We can find the same message in the words of Jesus Christ, who says, Father, you and I are one. Saint Gregory Palamas, who is one of the greatest theologians of the Christian Orthodox Church, said, For the kingdom of heaven, nay, rather the King of heaven, is within us. We can go to the Jewish tradition, to the famous Kabbalist Avraham ben Shemuel Abulafia, who taught that he and we are one. According to Mohammed, whoso knows himself knows his Lord. Al-Halaj, the Sufi mystic, was executed because of his statement, I saw my Lord with the eye of the heart. I said, Who art thou? He answered, Thou. The idea expressed in the Sufi mystical tradition is Ana al-Haq, I am God, I am the absolute truth, I am the true reality. Another very interesting thing to mention is the extreme difficulty that people have when they are trying to describe these experiences. They typically talk about ineffability, yet, you know, they usually try to find some way of talking about it. People who are educated and well-read frequently resort to Oriental languages, for example, using Sanskrit or Japanese or Chinese or Tibetan words. They might be using expressions like Samadhi for the union with God, Shunyata for the void, Kundalini for the serpent power. They might be talking about Bardo, the intermediate state between death and birth, the Buddhist term anatta, meaning no self, satori, the Zen term for enlightenment, nirvana, or ki energy, chi energy, and so on. Or when they talk about the everyday life, they might be using terms like samsara, the world of birth and death, or maya, illusion, avidya, which is the term for ignorance. Now, the preference for these terms reflects the fact that these cultures were very knowledgeable in relation to non-ordinary states of consciousness. They had traditions and technologies that made it possible to gain access to these experiences, so they developed terminology which specifically applies to these states, whereas our language basically relates to objects and situations of everyday reality and is not really equipped to deal with these transcendental realities. Some people make a compromise and they resort to the words of poetry. They would sort of refer to Omar Khayyam or Rumi or Khalil Gibran or Kabir, Sri Aurobindo, or from our own tradition, people like William Blake or Rilke. It seems that the language of poetry, although also not really fully equipped to describe transcendental realities, is somehow capable to capture those experiences better than our everyday language. Then when we have this experience, we know that this is the source of creation, and we frequently ask the question, why creation? From a human perspective, to be able to experience identification with this principle is an incredible, it's a fantastic experience. And so the question is, why would not that supreme principle just simply stay in its pristine condition? Why would it have to enter this process of creation? And people volunteer a number of insights. It's not something that could be sort of stated in a very simple way. Some of these answers that you hear have something to do with the incredible richness and infinite potential which is contained in this creative principle. The idea that it's so enormous and so overbearing that it cannot be contained and simply has to be expressed. Other people emphasize another factor, which is that divine in this undifferentiated form has enormous potential and has tremendous need to get to know itself. And in order to do that, it has to project, sort of manifest, express, concretize somehow these undifferentiated potentials. This kind of parallels certain insights in medieval Kabbalistic scriptures that describe that the motive for creation was that God wanted to see God. The way it's described is face wanted to see face. So that creation then is this incredible effort for self-knowledge, or self-disclosure of the divine. Sometimes creation is likened to this incredible piece of art or incredible experiment reflecting this enormous curiosity of the divine principle. But we can also sometimes hear that people have insights of a very different nature, which suggests that divine is also somehow seeking in creation something that is missing in its pristine form. So it reflects some kind of want or absence of something. The most common insight of this kind is that as fantastic as the experience of the divine principle is, that the creative principle is aware of the fact that it's alone and that it has tremendous need for a partnership, for sharing, for exchange. The motivation for creation is described then as this tremendous need to give love and receive love. That, of course, requires the world of plurality, that the divine can then experience it in a kind of surrogate form, in the form of its creation. Another interesting perspective here is that the divine is seeking in creation everything that it isn't and that it doesn't have in its pristine form. So it's kind of ethereal. It's a spiritual principle. It is infinite. It is eternal. And what it finds in creation is something that is concrete, tangible, that is time-limited, and so on. This aspect is beautifully illustrated in one of the Aztec codices, which is called Codex Borbonicus, which has a picture of two deities involved in this complementary dance. One of these deities is Quetzalcoatl as the plumed serpent, representing spirit, and the other one is Tezcatlipoca, or the smoking mirror, representing matter. And this is this complementary dance of two entities, each of them somehow seeking what it doesn't have. Sometimes we hear insights emphasizing monotony, that again, as fantastic as the experience of the pristine, undifferentiated consciousness, absolute consciousness is, that it is always the same, and that there is this profound craving for change, for drama. The extreme statement I have heard is that it involves divine boredom, and it's interesting that again, this is something that we find in certain Kabbalistic scripts, that God created the world because of boredom. And of course the Hindu concept of lila, of creation as a kind of divine play, that the creative principle is playing with himself, herself, is a kind of divine amusement or self-entertainment, a fantastic adventure in consciousness. So those are the insights that people have at this point, where they are trying to understand why creation happens. There's also another category of insights that comes frequently together with this kind of experience, which has to do not with the reason for creation or the motive for creation, the why of creation, but the how of creation. How is it done? What are the processes which are involved? And again, here people typically describe two processes which kind of interact with each other and complement each other. The first of these processes is the process of multiple divisions. The idea is that somehow the creative principle creates within itself and from itself by splitting into infinite, countless number of kind of derived units of consciousness. On one level, this could be the different archetypal figures involved in these mythological dramas. And then in the last expression, it would be then the multiplicity of the material world, the, you know, enormous number of people, animals, plants, inorganic matter, and so on. So it's a process that goes from the undifferentiated oneness into the world of plurality. And then the second process that would be involved, sort of, and going hand in hand with the other one, would be a process that some people refer to as cosmic partitioning, as cosmic screen work, but many people prefer psychological terms like forgetting or dissociation. The idea here is that at a certain point, the split units of consciousness somehow lose the connection with the source, forget about the source and its existence, and they also start experiencing themselves as being separate in some absolute sense from each other. So we then get the creation of numbers of universes, phenomenal worlds existing on different levels, which is inhabited then by the units which are derived from the original creative principle, but at this point are experiencing themselves as independent entities. And this is a framework that provides enormous opportunities for adventures of various kinds and meet some of the needs, quote-unquote, of the divine that we described before. But this process that I've described so far seems to represent just half of the cosmic cycle of creation. Now, according to repeated insights, there's also a built-in system of opportunities for now or technologies that can provide the access to the mystical. There are two experiences that deserve special attention because they are important sources of these unitive experiences. One of them is sexuality. Sometimes when the circumstances are right, two people who really connect on many levels, intellectual, emotional, physical, they can experience lovemaking as a powerful unitive experience where they transcend the individual boundaries, they experience merging and oneness with each other, and they also feel that the boundary between them and the source has been lifted, and they experience connection with the source, or they identify with archetypal beings, and their lovemaking is not just a connection between two humans, but they experience it as a yin-yang union or Shiva-Shakti union. The other experience is delivery. Women who deliver a child under very good circumstances can experience a very, very powerful unitive experience where they feel one with the child and one with the environment and so on. Now, both of those experiences are kind of ambiguous because they can also, under the wrong circumstances, lead to more alienation. Sex, when it's pursued from a very egocentric, exploitative kind of perspective, can actually send the person deeper into the world of alienation rather than providing a kind of a tantric access to a unitive experience. And in a very similar way, a difficult, traumatic birth can actually cut off the mother and the child from the divine rather than bringing them closer to it. So we have now seen that according to the insights from non-ordinary states, the universe existence is this extremely complex process which involves a movement from the undifferentiated unity into the world of plurality, or the worlds of plurality, and then return from the phenomenal worlds back to the undifferentiated unity. Now, within this context, we assume an identity which is quite different from how we think about ourselves in everyday life. We become a kind of a split unit of an alienated unit, which is, in a sense, an integral part of the divine principle itself. And here emerges a very interesting question, which is, if it is true that our nature is divine, how come that we opt somehow for the body ego? What is the process that makes it possible for this sort of infinite spiritual being to experience itself as this sort of limited material entity? Now, the best answer I have heard to this question is that essentially the divine traps itself by its own perfection. Now, as we heard before, one of the insights into the motivation of creation is that the divine needs to experience something that it isn't and that it doesn't have, and this is fulfilled by the experience of the material, of the tangible world. Now, according to this insight, the facsimile of this material world is created with such perfection that it becomes absolutely believable and convincing for the split units of consciousness, and extremely difficult to extricate oneself from that delusion, which is what the Hindus called Maya. I remember in particular one person whom I worked with in Baltimore, and he had this insight into the reality that he saw suddenly as Lila, as the play of divine consciousness, and he was asking this question, you know, how is it possible that we forget our own divinity? What is the secret of this process that Alan Watts, the Anglo-American philosopher and writer, called the taboo against knowing who you are? And he said, I can see the important function that the creation of the ordinary, the trivial, and the ugly has in creating this kind of illusion of ordinary reality. He said, if we were these spiritual beings sort of floating in the air and taking our nourishment directly from the sun, and we would be in this beautiful surrounding, we would look to the left and there is the range of the Himalayas, and we would look to the right and there is Grand Canyon, and in front of us is the sunset over the Pacific or the Aurora Borealis, and we're surrounded by Michelangelo's sculptures and we are listening to Beethoven's music, it would be absolutely clear to us that we are living in a divine domain. Now, we are in Baltimore, so he said, but look at our world, you know, look at Baltimore, these miles of ugly houses where these sort of boring, you know, ordinary people live their lives, snoring, belching, farting, and so on. Then you have the toilets with the obscene graffiti and all the smells, and you have junkyards or sort of ugly industrial quarters. It's a world in which the one that reveals the divine is just given in very small portions here and there, and the rest of it, the kind of reality that certainly is very difficult to identify as divine. And so he realized that one of the important tasks somehow that we have in the spiritual journey is to see the divine in the lowly, in the trivial, in the banal. It's very easy to see it in the glorious. From this perspective, we also can see a perfection in certain things which are imperfect, and we cannot see the same kind of hierarchical order that we usually see. For example, from an ordinary perspective, a chimpanzee is a much lower form of life than a human, particularly somebody like Einstein, who towers over ordinary humans. Now, from the perspective I'm talking about, there's no hierarchical difference between Einstein and a chimpanzee, because ultimately, within the cosmic game, chimpanzee is God playing perfectly the role of a chimpanzee, and Einstein is God playing perfectly the role of Einstein. For example, if we look at theater, it doesn't make Laurence Olivier anything less when he plays poor Yorick than when he plays Hamlet, as long as he presents a good performance. In a very similar way, if we look at something like Kitsch, you know, which is a very low-level human performance from the ordinary perspective, particularly if we compare it with something like Michelangelo. But from this perspective, again, if the intention was specifically to add the phenomenon of Kitsch into the cosmic game, it is perfect for what it is. So these are some interesting insights into this taboo against knowing who we are. So according to these insights, one of the elements responsible for the intensity of the taboo against knowing who we are would be the perfection with which the process of creation is executed. But many people see also another element, which is the fact that many of the pathways to reunion are fraught with tremendous difficulties and dangers. For example, people who had mystical experiences in Middle Ages would likely end up in the hands of the Inquisition and be tortured and killed or burnt at a stake in auto-da-fés. In modern times, we don't have the Inquisition, but we have psychiatry. Many of the people who had what in other cultures would be considered powerful mystical experiences would get labels, would be considered psychotic, would be hospitalized and treated with tranquilizing medication. Psychedelics certainly are a very powerful means for reunion, for getting a lot of cosmic insights, having spiritual experiences. But as we saw very shortly after psychedelics were introduced into our culture, there was the chromosomal scare. They were made illegal. There was the question of the purity of the substances. There was the question of psychotic breaks and flashbacks. So what happened, it actually, as Ramakrishna would say, it thickened the plot, but it didn't provide an easy escape route from the world of samsara, of the world illusion. The other thing we can mention in this context is that the whole worldview of materialistic science really became a very strong impediment of any kind of a spiritual pursuit, simply because it equated spirituality with something that's related to lack of education, ignorance, gullibility, primitive magical thinking, or emotional immaturity, a tendency to project primitive infantile images of one's parents to heavens and making gods of them, and so on. And so the authority that materialistic science has in our culture becomes also a very, very difficult obstacle and obstruction for any kind of serious spiritual quest. Another important element is religion, mainstream religion, which to a great extent is devoid of true spirituality. So in a sense, for many people, again, it becomes something that interferes with genuine spiritual quest, which would have led to direct experience of the numinous dimensions of reality. I have a close friend, Walter Houston Clark, who is a retired professor of religion, and he wrote very well-known book on the psychology of religion. And after teaching psychology of religion for 25 years, he actually had a powerful mystical experience. And after that, he used to say that he can see how much of mainstream religion actually resembles vaccination. He said, you go to church and you get a little something that then protects you against the real thing. You're told that just coming on a Sunday to a church service makes you a deeply religious person, and that really prevents you from any kind of a spiritual search that would actually provide direct connection to the sacred dimensions of reality, which would then lead to genuine spirituality. There are many of the activities of mainstream church that are really misleading, because they put focus on things that have very little to do with spirituality, like whether women can become priests or whether we can use contraception, a very strange kind of activity at a time when we have the problem of overpopulation and we have the specter of AIDS, and to focus somehow the effort on such issues fundamentally confuses somehow the issue, what is spirituality and what is important in the spiritual quest. Another question that people very frequently ask on many different levels and in many different ways, many different forms, is why is evil part of creation? And we can really experience evil of enormous proportion, you know, not just the kind of evil that might be associated with our postnatal existence of the things that we see around us, but also discovery of the Jungian shadow within us, just destructive and self-destructive forces of enormous proportions. People in this kind of process can discover Hitler within, Genghis Khan within, feel in a way responsible for the evil in the world. You can have also the experience of the archetypal realm, and you realize that the pantheon of the deities is dichotomized. There are archetypal principles that are benevolent, that are blissful. There are also those that have tremendous potential for evil. So with this emerges the question, why is evil in the world? Is it really a necessary part of creation? And if it is, why? So some of the insight that I have heard is evil has to be in the world because creation is creation out of nothing. Creatio ex nihilo, which means that everything that's created has to be accompanied with its polarity. You can't just create on the one side of the spectrum. A much more interesting insight is that the existence of evil has something to do with the richness of creation, that somehow it provides a necessary contrast and depth for creation. It's hard to imagine a beautiful sunrise if it doesn't follow after a dark, cold night. We wouldn't have healing if it were not preceded by disease. We don't have enlightenment unless it follows kind of endarkenment and so on. When they once asked Ramakrishna, Swamiji, why is evil in the world? His answer was very interesting. He said, to thicken the plot. Now, this is obviously an answer which seems very cynical, particularly if we imagine what we are talking about. We are talking about children being burned by napalm or dying of hunger in Somalia. We are talking about Nazism, about communism, about the apartheid and so on, about the Chinese invasion of Tibet, you know, incredible brutalities that were perpetrated. But if we do a little thought experiment, we'll get a very different perspective. So let us imagine for a moment that the world never had the dark side, never had the side that we would consider evil. And we can start maybe with diseases. That means nobody has ever been sick. Now we cannot eliminate diseases and do it in a kind of a clean surgical fashion, isolated from everything else. What happens that when we eliminate diseases, we also eliminate all the healers. You know, we don't need shamans or the Filipino psychic surgeons. We don't need the whole history of medicine. We lose the heroes that dedicated their lives to the fight against diseases. We lose the Virchows, the Pasteurs, and so on, the discovery of the penicillin, the excitement about heart transplant and so on. We also lose all the people who dedicated their life by helping sick and suffering people. We don't need Mother Teresa with her Nobel Prize. Albert Schweitzer with his Lambarene experiment. So we lose a significant part of reality. Then we can sort of aim our attention at another aspect, which represents certainly the dark side of creation. And that's wars, fights, battles, violence, and so on. So let's say there never has been violence in the world. So what we lose also is now all the heroes, all the freedom fighters, people fighting totalitarian system, fighting for freedom. We lose the entire history of making weapons. We lose the whole history of defending oneself against weapons. We lose all the fortifications. We lose all the medieval castles, the museums that exhibit some of these artifacts. But we also lose all pieces of art and all movies that were inspired by this. There wouldn't be much left of the Hollywood archives, for example. So not just music, but paintings and sculpture and literature and so on. Now, if we continue doing this, we end up with a world that's going to be so flat and so uninteresting that if it were made into a movie, we wouldn't bother to go see it. My friend Tef Sparks is very much involved in writing screenplays for movies. And before he started writing screenplays, he studied a lot of literature about how to write screenplays. And one of these handbooks had a very explicit statement that if one would like to have a guaranteed flop, you would make a movie about a life in a happy village. So some of the people who really integrate well their experiences, they somehow have to accept the dark side of creation as an integral part of existence and somehow make their peace with it. Now, the important thing to consider is that, in a sense, the divine is in the universal scheme in all the roles, in the roles of the victims and the perpetrators. There's a beautiful poem by Thich Nhat Hanh, which is called Call Me By My True Names, which shows this aspect of creation, where he talks about being the girl who was raped by the pirates, but also being the pirate who raped the girl, and being the caterpillar, and also being the bird who comes and eats the caterpillar, and so on. So this is an important part of it, that in a sense, from a larger perspective, the divine really, because it's in all the roles, it's really, in a sense, doing it all to itself. Now, the most important problem related to this way of seeing reality is related to the practical consequences of that. If really, you know, evil is part of divine creation, and if what is good and evil is in, to a great extent, relative, why should I act ethically and morally? What's wrong about just walking around chopping of heads? You know, nobody dies anyway, and it's all God. This is a problem that Carl Gustav Jung ran into when he became aware of the relativity of good and evil and struggled with it for quite a while until he found an answer for himself, which was basically that because good and evil is relative, each of our ethical acts is a creative act where we do the best we can from what we know and who we are. Maybe 2 years from now we'll see it differently, but in a particular situation, we did the best we could. Now, another important thing to consider, as we go through the inner process where we are making these insights that I'm talking about, we are also being transformed. We are changing ourselves. So at the time when we come to accept the evil, we have also worked through a lot of aggressive impulses within ourselves so that we don't feel the inclination to participate in evil actions. At that time, we also discover something like the possibility of reincarnation and the law of karma. And if we don't want to experience certain consequences, there are certain things that we will not do. Then we could have a number of transpersonal experiences where we discover our essential identity with other sentient beings. So we realize that what we would be doing to others, we would be in essence doing to ourselves. So the same process that somehow leads to acceptance of evil also, to a great extent, mitigates and eliminates somehow the motivation to be a perpetrator. As we discuss these different aspects of the cosmic game, the way it is seen by people who experience non-ordinary states, we see that what emerged out of this work is a kind of encompassing transpersonal vision of ourselves and realities, And this vision is in fundamental conflict with the worldview developed by materialistic science, but at the same time, it represents a very strong support for the fundamental assumptions of the schools of what Aldous Huxley called perennial philosophy. And also, on the other hand, it shows increasing convergence with the discoveries in modern science that have been referred to as the new or the emerging paradigm.
This concludes tape 5. Our program continues with tape 6.